This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. As San Antonio deals with more and more people moving into the area, this is putting stress on local housing. What's happening with fair housing and public housing in San Antonio? How do we make sure that low income and fixed income don't get pushed out during this housing crunch? We invite you to call in. The number is 210-614-8980. What are your concerns about housing in San Antonio? What do you see coming? The number again, 210-614-8980. What do you think we should be doing now in order to prevent a housing crisis later? You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at @tprsource. Our guests this afternoon, we're joined by David Nesivacha. He is the president and CEO of the San Antonio Housing Authority. LeVar Martin is the director of programs for the National Association of Latino Community Asset Builder, NALCAB. And Sandra Tomez is the executive director of the Fair Housing Council of Greater San Antonio. And again, the number to call in is 210-614-8980. So LeVar Martin, let me ask you first, since you're the National Association of Latino Community Asset Builders, what are you looking at? What are you seeing nationally? Because this is happening all over the country. It's not just San Antonio. Some cities have already got it harder first. But what are you seeing here locally as well?
Sure. So I would say the trends we're seeing in San Antonio, to your point, are happening all over the country. We are doing work in Philadelphia, in New York, in Los Angeles. And what we've seen is the main driver for these neighborhood changes, especially close to urban cores, has been public investment. Now, whether that's incentives for housing, whether that's transportation investments, whether that's infrastructure, but a lot of the drivers, the initial drivers of neighborhood change have been some type of catalytic public investment. So we really try to use data and analysis to try to get ahead of it as much as possible and try to anticipate which neighborhoods and communities are going to be vulnerable.
So public investment in creating what, affordable housing?
That's right. So, well, I wouldn't say necessarily it could be affordable housing. It could be incentives for private development. It could be
like tax offsets, things like that.
That's another example for sure.
Okay. So, but the local government has a role, and it has been shown that they can provide get results in dealing with situations that we know that San Antonio has. And they can do something. Something can be done.
They can. So if you think about the decade of downtown, right, the city did, thinking about its public investments, doing what it should be doing, trying to drive economic development downtown, which they were successful at. I would say that the, you know, what we need to do is think about what impact those investments have long term, not just, you know, the immediate economic impact, but 3, 5, 10 years down the road. What impact are those catalytic investments having on the communities in our urban core?
Okay, say you don't do anything and we just let market forces run their course. What do you get?
You get inequitable neighborhoods.
What does that look like?
You get displaced.
I mean, describe it to somebody who doesn't know what that means.
Sure. You get people who don't have the choice to make their own decisions about where they live. You get extreme. We did a housing assessment for the Mission District in San Francisco. You get, a two-bedroom apartment that's over $4,000. Now, we're a long way from San Francisco, but it doesn't mean that we can't do what we need to do now to mitigate the negative impacts that can occur with significant investment.
If you wait until the two-bedroom apartments is $4,000 a month, then that's too late.
It's absolutely too late. I think the main point is that moment when we institute that incentive, that those public funds for that economic development project, that's the moment where you need to institute preservation and affordability incentives and policies as well.
So
not down the line, right at the beginning.
So what happens to a city when you have a situation like that, where there really is no affordable housing? How does that impact overall economic growth and sustainability for a community?
Well, I think you talk about economic development for who? So for those that can afford it, it's a good thing. I think there are some benefits to the city when they're able to generate that type of revenue as a city. When you're talking about equity and diversity and affordability, it has the opposite effect. You lose culture, you lose, your city can lose identity, and it's a reason why you need to try to get ahead of it as soon as you can.
And you lose workers? I mean, if you don't have a place to live, if it takes you got to move out into the rural areas to find a place, or that's a hardship.
Yeah, it's absolutely a hardship.
And so let me go over to David, president and CEO of the San Antonio Housing Authority. What's your role in this? How do you try to prevent us from getting there?
Right. Well, first of all, David, thank you for having us on, and I appreciate the platform. I believe SAHA's role is to be an advocate as well as to be a developer of affordable housing, which can take the form of many different aspects. It could take, we can advocate for the existing housing stock to ensure that there's the proper investment going into that. And obviously, we can advocate and develop new housing stock for affordability, where you would see potentially under the description you provided earlier, where you would see those people who need to access affordable housing in the city center or in the near neighborhoods would be driven out by the market, which is ever increasing in price and volume. All of a sudden, they would lose that opportunity because transportation is expensive. Most of those people in that price point don't have dependable transportation. Even though VIA is a great partner on many different levels with the agency, they don't have specifically designed bus routes to cater people to a specific employment center unless it's a very large one. So our role is to make sure that we have the infrastructure in place, that we're anticipating areas that we need to set aside property so we can develop and maintain the affordable housing stock for the clients and the residents of San Antonio who so vastly need it and deserve it.
People think of the Housing Authority, San Antonio Housing Authority, SAHA, as the landlord. You own a lot of land, you got a lot of property in San Antonio, you operate Section 8 housing and public housing in the city, provide vouchers for people who can get them. But do you think that the role is greater than that?
Yes, I do. As I mentioned previously, I think we have to look at traditional housing authorities under the new dynamics that are being presented to us, whether it be from federal regulation or funding sources ever decreasing. An agency needs to shift its priorities and I won't say its mission. The mission is core to who we are, service those who can't service themselves, who are looking for an opportunity. So I believe our mission stays the same, but we need to change our business attitude so we can survive. So, for instance, we work with TDHCA, which is a state organization which gives us awards tax credits. And the way that the QAP, which is the Qualified Application Plan, is the application process, scores those, it's making it ever more difficult for housing authorities to receive 9 or 4% tax credits based upon the scoring system. So it's incumbent upon us to be an advocate to see if we can change that system so more inner city traditional neighborhoods can benefit from the economic boom and the more stable housing that's coming along with the newer developments, all the while making sure that we have the investment to secure the existing housing we already have.
So I know there's a lot on your plate, and you get a lot going on. It's very technical, and it's hard stuff that you do, David. But what is the role that SAHA has? And we'll get into this. We've got to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk more about this. In being the voice of talking about what's happening in San Antonio with housing, being the front man of the band, of saying we've got to let everyone know what's happening and communicate and get everyone understanding the situation so that we avoid a crisis down the line. Also, when we come back, we'll talk about what's happening with the Alazan Apache Courts and the redevelopment there. We'll talk about fair housing in San Antonio. What happens if you've been discriminated in a mortgage loan or trying to buy some real estate here in San Antonio? Who do you turn to? The number to call is 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Affordable and fair housing in San Antonio. If we take their eye off the ball, what will happen in the city? We've seen in other places across the country. You heard it from LeVar Martin over at the National Association of Latino Community Asset Builders that we see gentrification. We see people pushed out of neighborhoods. We see results that are bad for the entire city. That's why communities are realizing they do need to invest in affordable public housing in order to stabilize neighborhoods. What do you think? What do you want to see happening in San Antonio? The number to call in is 210-614-8980. We had a caller, but he dropped off. We're going to take him now, but he dropped off. His Joey, and his question was, he was saying that public housing is a magnet for crime. And this is a a view that a lot of people have. And so I wonder if you could address that. David Nezavacha is the president and CEO of the San Antonio Housing Authority.
Right. Well, I appreciate the question and the opportunity to address a fallacy, actually, that permeates.
Yeah, we got to get it out there.
Yeah, that permeates within the community. You know, crime has always been a concern not only for the Housing Authority, but for any neighborhood, for any person who owns or invests in real estate and any citizen of San Antonio. So we've run the stats to take a look at our crime stats on our specific properties versus the city in its entirety in specific neighborhoods. And quite honestly, we follow the same waves that the city follows in regards to the type of crime and the amount of crime. I'm happy to say that the majority of our properties that property crimes have gone down, I think about 7 to 10%, and we're seeing a small spike on a small number of properties that where there is a negative influence of violent crime, but less so than the greater city of San Antonio. We work rather closely with our resident boards and with SAPD, and we have a security contingent to ensure that we're doing everything we can to ensure the safety of our residents, their visitors, and the greater community. So I'm very happy and proud of the strides that we've made in decreasing crime at our properties. And I would also advocate if anybody references or sees or anticipates an activity that's going on, that they should reach out to SAPD and give them a phone call.
Senator Temez, Executive Director of the Fair Housing Council of Greater San Antonio, if someone thinks that they have been discriminated in trying to apply for a mortgage, or lending, buying a home, what do they do?
Well, they can file a complaint with a local organization like ourselves. They could file a complaint with HUD. HUD is the government agency responsible for enforcing, you know, this Federal Fair Housing Act. They could file a civil lawsuit. For our area, we serve San Antonio, Bexar County, but also 36 surrounding South Texas counties. We take complaints from consumers, try to resolve that informally, do our own private investigation to try to uncover evidence of the discrimination. So in lending, maybe if a consumer felt that they weren't getting fair treatment, or maybe not getting full information about available loan products, feel that it may be due to their race, they could file a complaint with our office. We have mystery shoppers that we use, regular consumers, regular individuals from the community that we train on how to simulate a housing search. And with the lender, we'd have people, someone, let's say if it was a race-based complaint, someone African-American go into that particular lender's business and inquire about a loan products. Of course, they wouldn't actually apply. They would just be gathering information, but we can tell whether discrimination happens even at that introductory period. And then we'd have someone that is Caucasian go into the same same business. In a perfect world, there shouldn't be any differences. If the lender has a policy that you have to be pre-qualified in order to even get information about loan products, that policy should be enforced for both of our mystery shoppers, right? So it shouldn't be easier for the Caucasian mystery shopper to get information about loan products and have a meeting, sit down, and get educated about that process. There shouldn't be any differences. And then when they are, you know, because we create a whole little profile for them about where they work and how much money they make, what their credit score is, how much money they have in saving that's available for the down payment. And so we already do our own kind of pre-qualification before they go in. And we see if there's any differential treatment, because an ideal world, that shouldn't be happening, right? So they should get the same information about loan products, the same information about interest rates. And credit does play a factor. But when we send in individuals with similar credit scores and similar financial information, job history, et cetera, there shouldn't really be differences when they get some type of pre-qualification.
And what are your results? What did you see? Do you see people, even though they come in with identical backgrounds and credit history, that some people get quoted a higher interest rate than another, and the conclusion that one might make is because based upon race?
So we haven't done lending studies in many years. We did, I would say, probably 15 years back. It's been quite a while. The majority of our work is based on complaints from consumers. It's very consumer-driven, and I think part of that problem is that you know, we try to educate consumers about how to recognize and report discrimination, but a lot of times I think consumers, you know, we put trust in our loan officers and our realtors that they're, you know, taking us to homes in the areas where we want to live in, that they're providing us full and equal information about loan products. And a lot of consumers, especially first-time homebuyers, are not aware and how to really recognize maybe the fact that they're not being provided information about conventional and FHA loans and don't know the difference between the two. And so I think one of the things that we try to do and other advocates try to do is really help consumers recognize the fact that there are differences in these loan products, that they should ask, be more proactive themselves in asking for information about both loan products, and then also shop around, right? So not just go with the first lender you go to and see if there's any differences there. Because a lot of times consumers just aren't, it's not as obvious, you know, it's not in your face discrimination. You know, HUD always says it's hands with a, discrimination with a handshake and a smile. And so they don't come right out and say, oh, you're Latino, so, you know, it's going to be a little harder to get this loan for you, right? So it, instead, it's like they're making it, maybe steering them toward an FHA loan that has disadvantages to a conventional loan. And so we really, I think, for ourselves, try to
educate. So it's very subtle.
Yeah, yeah. And it, for consumer, it's really hard to recognize. Even myself, when I first bought my home, you know, I was kind of pushed toward an FHA loan. I asked about a conventional, but kind of was told this is the one that suited me better. Later, a couple years later, I refinanced and specifically pushed for a conventional loan and was able to refinance into a conventional loan. But still wonder myself, and I work in this field, why I wasn't able to get a conventional loan at the get-go. You know what I mean? So I, you know, I inquired about it at the very beginning, but was told that based on, you know, my assets and my debts, et cetera, the FHA would look, work better for me, you know, but 2 years later refinanced into conventional and not really know. So I think it is difficult for consumers to know, but I always encourage consumers. Sometimes it's a gut feeling. Sometimes it's maybe something someone said, is to call our office, call your local fair housing organization and have them do some secret shopper, these mystery shopper, assignments so that we can kind of see if there's differences, because there's no way of knowing. And that's why this kind of testing or mystery shopper assignments that we do are so important, because it's not in your face and we need to be able to try to uncover these discriminatory differences that are going on, because we do know what's going on, right? There've been, you know, revealed it, their analysis of HMDA data. So
right now we're seeing interest rates ticking up, and the expectation is that they are going to go up. Do you think that's going to exacerbate the situation with people trying to find a good loan and discrimination?
Well, I mean, interest rates impact, right, your ability to qualify. The lower the interest rates, the better it might be. I think that it's still very individual, right? So when we're dealing with lending, there is still an individual assessment of every consumer. But I think there's still, like, when we're looking at credit, though, I think there needs to be a way to look at credit. I mean, people based on their ethnicity have different, you know, don't have the same level or access to credit. And there needs to be kind of an assessment of that to figure out how there could be a different analysis of credit so that people could qualify. Because if you... I think kind of research has shown that, let's say if you're Latino, then you may not be using credit in the same way that someone Caucasian is. You know, you might have the same level. You might not, if you don't have the money for it, you're not going to get a credit card and then spend. So you're going to, if you got the money, you'll use it to buy whatever you need, but you're not going to get credit cards to, and not knowing really that in order to sometimes qualify for these loans, they look to see whether or not you have established credit. And of course, how much you've used on that line of credit.
Let me go over to LeVar Martin. You wanted to respond to that.
I did. I would just say that, you know, I agree. And I think it's important to also invest in our nonprofit capacity, as you were saying, about the service providers. Also invest in our community development financial institutions who offer alternative products, including financial capability, different loan products that are more accessible for many of the communities that we serve.
Do you see interest rates going up? Is that going to be an issue with gentrification and problems like that?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know if there's going to be a direct tie between interest rates and gentrification. I will say that, you know, again, it's an issue that's facing many of our communities. And
I mean, because if housing becomes even more expensive, sure, because the interest rates are going to go up, that could impact already what we know as an affordable housing gap.
Right. So when there's not enough production, interest rates are going up, people are attracted to certain areas of town.
And people who build are going to look to maximize their investments.
Their investments, right. It does put many of the neighborhoods in and around our urban core at risk.
It's going to cost more money to borrow money to rehab homes. So, I mean, this could have a ripple effect all through trying to solve the situation that San Antonio and other communities find themselves in. And so, I mean, David, over at the Saha, do you see the interest rates going up as an issue?
Actually, we do, because what I see and what we deal with are people who are, on average, making $13,000 a year. So, you know, those are our typical clients, public housing and Section 8. And we try to prepare them for opportunities for home ownership, because we do believe opportunity lives here, whether it be the Housing Authority or San Antonio in general. And we're trying to fill that gap of affordable home ownership. Currently at Mirasol Homes on the west side of town, we're building 40 homes that range in from 3 bedrooms to 5 bedrooms at a price point to $120,000 to $150,000 a year. And the typical developer in San Antonio is now building stuff at an average of about $220,000 a year. So what that means for the question that you're proposing is less people will have an opportunity to afford a home, which is the number way to build investment and income over the lifespan of your family. Therefore, we're not changing people's outcomes or history with their family nearly as many opportunities as we can get. The quickest way to change a family's fortune is through home ownership and to be able to get that investment. So rising interest rates shallows that pool for people who have that opportunity, and something we're greatly concerned about. And I think we're the only developer in town with very few others who are trying to hit that niche between 150 and 170 because they're viable homeowners who need to develop that wealth for generations.
So if you get into Mirasol Homes, you can build the equity in your home that you could tap into later on, maybe to send a child to college or have retirement. This is a way to build up wealth for the long term.
Right. It's one thing we've learned is nothing is stagnant and all by itself. You know, if you're able to get affordability in a home, which is also energy conservationist and perspective, those monies can help you and lead you towards better health care, better education choices, transportation choices, job centers, and workforce training. So it all flows to one another. So that's why we want to hit that market, because we believe in ever expanding the option for affordable home ownership, because the impact it has over the generations of the family are just never ending.
Yeah, and so we had a bond election recently, and there was money set aside for some sort of inner city development of homes. And is that going to be tie into what you just talked about?
Well, unfortunately, the way the city charter is written, the San Antonio Housing Authority cannot participate in the bond. Now, we are advocates of affordable housing, so whether it's us or anybody else, a nonprofit or a for-profit developer who wants to do affordable elements, we're happy that they're getting the opportunity to participate in the $20 million. You know, I would say that $20 million is a good first step. You look at other cities around the nation. I was reading an article this morning. Now, you know, we're different economic points in other cities, but they're setting aside $250 million, which is quite drastically different from $20 million. But I'm very happy San Antonio saw the wisdom of taking that first step and dedicating monies for affordable housing.
Well, it would be interesting to hear from listeners and what they thought about taking further steps in trying to deal with San Antonio's housing crunch. Could be a crisis down the line if we don't take action. We know that public input, public dollars are critical. They can be leveraged to try to deal with this and help provide affordable housing for so many. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. Do you see the effects of gentrification in your neighborhood? Have you experienced discrimination with renting, buying, securing financing for homes? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Maternal mortality rates in Texas are the worst in the nation, but numbers are bleaker still for Black women. In Texas, Black women account for almost 30% of all maternal deaths.
And this is a disgrace and a national imperative that we really have to address that.
This story and the composer who's been commissioned to write music for San Antonio's tricentennial celebration on Fronteras. Download Fronteras wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about affordable and fair housing in San Antonio. This is an issue that affects everyone. As we have a housing crunch, it does drive up the home prices in San Antonio, and you're going to feel that in your tax bill and your assessments. But if we can figure out ways to develop more housing opportunities for more people, it will stabilize neighborhoods. It will prevent these run-ups and spikes in home prices. We're on Facebook today, and we've gotten some comments from some of the viewers there, from Alan. Houses in my neighborhood are being flipped from $50,000 to up to $280,000 with minimal investments. We need restrictions that do not allow investors to resell homes in a five-year period. We need property tax caps for lower-income homeowners in our downtown neighborhoods to assist them so they're not displaced by tax increases. We need more tools to help protect affordable housing in our diverse neighborhoods. So let me go to LeVar Martin, the director of the programs for the National Association of Latino Community Asset Builder. And these protections that Alan is talking about, are these practical? Are these things that a city can adopt?
So it depends. It's, you know, there's a lot to talk about the impact of taxes and what you can and can't do, but a lot of that is controlled at the state level.
So basically, no.
Basically, no. It would be difficult to do. I do think that the way we incentivize private development, even though we can't do inclusionary zoning, you can incentivize affordable housing. So if you're going to use public funds and developers want to use public funds for their projects, you can incentivize them to make certain units affordable if they want access to the funds.
Flipping homes has become a cultural phenomenon. We got TV shows and magazines and all sorts of people who do this very well or become like media celebrities. When something like that happens, that should be a sign that there's something going on here. What do you make of that, David?
Well, I have a split mind. In some regards, you know, the private market is going to always exist, and that will ebb and flow with the current status of the economy and where people can see where they can put their most amount of money and make the highest investment. I think you have to balance that against the greater need of the neighborhood, of the community, of potentially that homeowner who's been in that house for 30, 40 years and all of a sudden feels the pressure of the gentrification happening and seeing the value of their house rise so greatly that they can't afford the taxes on their homes anymore. So I think there are some tools that potentially the city and the state could put into place that would allow for a balanced approach, whether it be for the private market or be for those people who are being impacted by the private market to have a soft landing in some regards. I would support measures like that because not every neighborhood is ready to turn. Not every person in that neighborhood is ready to turn at the speed that the private market is starting to have an impact, whether it be in a Dignity Hill, whether it be in a Lavaca, whether it be in Southtown, wherever it might be. There's a fair amount of those residents there who still need some soft landing, and I believe that's where administrations, whether it be city, county, state, or federal, can have an impact in a positive way for those clients.
And Sandra Tomes, over at the Fair Housing Council of Greater San Antonio.
Well, I would just like to add that, you know, there is a mandate under the Federal Fair Housing Act that was passed in 1968 that requires government, local governments, any government that receives federal funding from HUD, which would be our community development block grant funds, to take proactive steps for the government itself, the local government, to evaluate its own, you know, economic and racial segregation within the city and take proactive steps to address it and to desegregate. So I think that there is this burden on the city. I know that the mayor has now created this housing policy task force to look to how to address this, but there is this burden and this requirement of the city because they get those $1 million of funds to take proactive steps to see what can be done for the existing homeowners that are in this area where the gentrification is happening. And if there are restrictions, we'll see what are other options that could be done, whether it's some type of supportive programs, financial programs that the city could create to help those individual homeowners that have been there for 20 years that are being impacted. So it's not like the city can't do anything. The city can do. And I think that's what they're working on. That's a positive step. But there's that mandate there that the city needs to take action.
Well, it's not just a mandate. It's just like that's how you create a city. Yeah. You have to protect all of your residents.
Exactly.
And you can't drive out your low-wage earners simply because the market is out of control. And the city is one of the few forces that can able to stand up and figure out ways to deal with these things, craft public policy, come up with the dollars necessary in order to deal with this economic wave that's hitting our legacy neighborhoods. We got a comment from Jack on Facebook. He says, define gentrification versus neighborhood revitalization. And that's a great question because, you know, we're not, I don't think many people are against trying to improve the quality of the neighborhoods. We see some homes that need help. People, their homes are falling down sometimes, and we got to come up with something, but is that necessarily gentrification? So let me go over to LeVar.
Sure. Great question. So there's not a, you know, when you look at academic research, there's not a consensus on a definition of gentrification. The definition that we use is when real estate price appreciation leads to involuntary displacement, which is key, involuntary displacement and significant cultural change. So I think that many of the neighborhoods that we work in absolutely need new investment, need revitalization, need updated housing, need that capital. But the people having the choice whether they stay in their homes or not, the involuntary displacement piece, and then how that significantly changes a neighborhood, the identity and the character of the neighborhood, would how I would say you differentiate between gentrification and revitalization.
And how do you define that, David Nisivacha, President and CEO of San Antonio Housing Authority?
I think he sums it up pretty well.
What are you looking for? Do you see things out there?
Well, you know, my job is to make sure we're trying to anticipate where the market's going to be because that impacts. We are a developer, the San Antonio Housing Authority. Yeah, we develop nonprofit properties typically by taking a look at our older properties and seeing how we can move them out of that economic model. And also, by the way, we believe that the physical environment contributes to the social outcomes. All right. So if we have a physical environment that is lending to outcomes that aren't positive, we need to take a look at how we can position people to make sure they have positive outcomes for themselves, for the family, for the community. So we're trying to always take a look at the real estate market and see what that has and the impact to our developments in general as a whole. So I think the previous definition is a really good definition. I think it's incumbent upon the Housing Authority to think forward and to also put ourselves in a position where we can tie properties, unlike the private market, to LURAs or to affordability indexes that secure them to be affordable for 30 or 40 years. You know, that's how I see that evolving.
So that brings us to Alazan Apache Quartz, because that's what you're dealing with right now. So Right. This is the West Side housing complex. It's a campus of, 33 acres, 501 apartments there, built in 1940, 78 years ago. These were spiffy at the time when they were built, but they've got some wear and tear. I mean, what are your plans out there?
Well, the Housing Authority applied for a choice implementation grant. We're currently in the application process. We're waiting for U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to award the five finalists or to say that these are the candidates for finalists. I believe we have a strong application based upon our experience on the east side of town with East Meadows, which has been a highly successful.
That's the former Wheatley Courts.
Yes, sir. And thank you for that clarification. A highly successful project neighborhood reinvestment opportunity. So we're looking to take the lessons we learned on the east side and bring those along.
San Juan Quartz and Zarzamora?
Yeah, San Juan, those were redeveloped through a tax credit process. You know, this would be a different process, but also we would get the funding through tax credits through TDHCA. And let me stipulate, the city has been a great partner for us. They contributed $20 million towards infrastructure at East Meadows, and they've committed to $21 million for Alazan. So the city's been a great partner. It ties back into a previous question about public improvements and what the city can do. One of the lessons we learned is we'd like to bring, since choice is, you know, it's people, buildings, and neighborhood, we'd like to make sure that the neighborhood's involved in this and that the improvements that impact the neighborhood are the first part of the improvements that happen. Because then there is a wealth of excitement that's coming not only to the buildings that are being redeveloped themselves, but to the greater neighborhood, whether that be through, you know, investment in lighting, in sidewalks, in drainage, whether that be an infill housing rehab, whatever it might be. So the city's been great in that. And so we're trying to make sure that our clients have positive outcomes because the physical elements of that neighborhood right now don't lend themselves to that.
But we have a situation where we have a lot of families that are living at the courts And those places are way overdue, and no one's going to argue another way about this. Is they're overdue for something, redevelopment or upgrade. But you just can't show up one day with the bulldozers and say, hey, everybody, we're going to rebuild this place. It's like changing the engines on an airplane on flight. You've got to figure out, what are you going to do with these individuals? A lot of them are infirmed, and they're older, and they have health issues, and they have a community of support. Mm-hmm. And you disrupt that, you really disrupt people's lives. How do you do that?
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. First of all, Alzon Apache is a family site where we do have some elderly disabled people living there, majority's family. But I would say one of the lessons we learned from East Meadows, previous Wheatley Courts, is you don't demolish everything at once and then try to build. You develop or you build a first phase. So people who want to retain the opportunity to live on that property or, you know, contingent or right next to it can live in that same neighborhood. You know, I think it's also important to note that you're giving people the opportunity of choice of where to live. And the choice that I have, the choice that you have, and many of the listeners have, we would provide that same choice to our clients, whether that be in public housing replacement vouchers or whether to come back to those public housing units that are on site. So we've done a rather aggressive public outreach campaign to our existing clients and to the greater community to get their feedback, because we're interested in that perspective. We want to make sure we're a good neighbor to everybody who lives there and people who are attracted to live there.
All right, we're going to keep talking about fair housing, affordable housing in San Antonio. If you got a question about what's happening to Alzon Apache Courts, because it's a cultural touchstone of San Antonio's west side, call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're seeing the rapid growth and development all over San Antonio, and it's impacting our neighborhoods. We're expecting 1 million more residents in the city by 2040. How is the city finding solutions not only for the demand for new homes, but also making sure that older residents are not pushed out, priced out, or developed out of their existing homes? And that's even including people who live in public housing. And so what's going on to protect San Antonio residents? What are we doing to make sure that the growth that we're bringing into San Antonio is done smartly to provide for stable neighborhoods? We invite you into the conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. So back over to Senator Tomez, the executive director of the Fair Housing Council of Greater San Antonio. So who is protected under the fair and local fair housing policies?
Okay, well, under the Federal Fair Housing Act that covers everyone that lives in our country, there are 7 protected classes. It's race, color, national origin, religion, sex, disability, and familial status. Our local ordinance, our non-discrimination ordinance, includes sexual orientation, veteran status, gender identity, and age. So for people living within the city limits of San Antonio, they have those additional 4 protected classes.
And so, that's enforced how? How often do y'all have to take enforcement action?
Well, we receive, in terms of complaints from consumers, the majority are out of Bexar County. We average about 450 complaints a year dealing specifically with housing discrimination. That's the people that we weed out, don't have just a regular landlord-tenant complaint or complaint with a housing provider. And then out of those, I would say about a smaller number, we're able to resolve complaints informally through our office, resolve complaints between consumers and housing providers. But we probably file about 50 or so a year with HUD. And then in terms of lawsuits, we also file lawsuits. I think last year we might have filed about 6 or 7. This year we're getting ready to file one based on familial status. This month we'll be filing another one dealing also next month, I think, on a different issue. So it
depends. What does that mean, familial status?
So discrimination because of the presence of children in a household. It's one of the areas where we actually see, when we see blatant discrimination and where people are still very vocal, it's against people with disabilities and families with children. That's where people don't really mask their stereotypes or prejudice. Sometimes it's with people with disabilities and families with children. So the one that we are filing this month is against a property management company that has one property in San Antonio, several in the Rio Grande Valley area, where they have overly restrictive rules against families with children, meaning your child can't even go outside and check the mail without a parent being accompanying them. They have to always be accompanied by their parent at all times. And in this case, it has to be a blood relative. Your child can't even play with the next door neighbor and have the neighbor's parent supervise the children. It has to be a blood relative. And so that's really hard for single moms, right? So you have people that are single parents that if you have the choice between, and it's being threatened with a $250 fine if they catch your children outside playing, just riding a bike or something. So we find that, and it's very common. It's very common in Texas. If I were to probably visit any apartment complex in this area, that I would go on the property and visibly see signs that restrict kids' activities, that have age restrictions to use the basketball court or to use the tennis courts or to even use the computer room. And that's discriminatory in fair housing. But a lot of times people think that management companies or property owners have the ability to regulate what kids can do on a property, and that's not true. When there are obvious dangers, a property owner or manager can make restrictions on certain activities in a particular area if there's danger in that area, but they can't not prevent a child from going outside and playing. I mean, I'm sure all of us, when we grew up, I spent the majority of my time outdoors, you know, unsupervised, and nothing happened to me. So that's kind of that's in terms of enforcement, that's one of the things that we're seeing now.
Let me go to the callers, and this is Elizabeth. And Elizabeth, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I've been on and off here because of traffic, David, but if I'm repeating, I apologize. But I'm wondering if families and elderly people who find themselves and they're on a fixed income or their poverty level find themselves in an area of development and tax rates going up, is there any provision in the tax code or in the government ordinances that would protect them from the rise in tax rates as long as they live there as a family dwelling? Because they're on a fixed income or they're senior citizens, so that they're not forced out by rising tax rates.
All right, Elizabeth, thank you for that call. And so, LeVar Martin, are you able to answer that question? Because I know that we do have provisions that we fix the taxes, how property taxes for individuals in San Antonio. Anyone who knows the details on that?
No, but I mean, I know the city, you know, through the Mayor's Housing Task Force Committee, which has got four subcommittees right now, is looking at opportunities to try to find a way to alleviate that burden. And if I'm not mistaken, one of the subcommittees deals with direct neighborhoods, and that's one of the issues they're looking at is gentrification and or displacement of its current residents. And it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that work of that subcommittee. I'm on another subcommittee. Saha's represented on every committee. We anticipate there's going to be some recommendations that come from all those committees, and some will be balanced against, you know, the client base who's on a fixed income who might be forced out based upon the tax pressures that are being put on them. So it'll be interesting what comes out of that work of those committees.
All right, another caller. This is Nick. And Nick, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you. I'm a federal engineer advisor in South Texas, all the way from Laredo all the way to Austin. And let me just comment that everybody's focusing that on public housing here in San Antonio, but that's a no-brainer for any agency to fix because the government already owns a property. Everybody is missing the major issue that San Antonio is one of the most economically segregated cities in the United States, and the cause of that is because of the South Side and the West Side. No one fixes it. So all the San Antonio Housing Authority, they just focus on public housing, but they're not really getting out any ideas on how to fix or fixing the South Side, which contributes to the economic segregation. So really, they have to come up with ideas, these agencies, because it's a no-brainer to fix public housing. But someone needs to come up with an idea to fix San Antonio on the South Side and the West Side.
All right, Nick, thank you for the call. And David?
Yeah, and I appreciate the call and the question. One thing I think that you've noticed through the mayor and the new city council is they developed a budget where they wanted to be equity-based in regards to the investment in the city and where it goes. I think traditionally you looked at certain neighborhoods who got the majority of that investment based upon the taxes that they were bringing in. So I believe the new budget and the approach to the budget is a positive for the city and for specifically some of the neighborhoods the caller referenced. Now, in regards to fixing public housing, you know, I don't want to sit here and take a whole nother hour and a half to define the challenges that we have in our industry, whether it's lack of sources of income that we're receiving. But it is incumbent upon housing authorities to find solutions. They're becoming more and more difficult based upon the restrictions that are put on us from a funding source level as well as a regulatory level. So we are constantly trying to persuade, whether it be local, statewide, regional, or national elected officials, to change some of those policies and procedures that will make those solutions a little easier. And one way we choose to do that is to go through the tax credit process, which we've been rather successful at. The San Antonio Housing Authority started mixed income housing in 2004, 2005. We were well ahead of the industry curve across the country in that. So I'm glad to be part of an industry leader who is continually challenged and striving to find those solutions.
So LeVar Martin, over at the National Association of Latino Community Asset Builder, to that call that Nick brings up about how that we have this situation in San Antonio where you can go from one side of town to the other and it looks like you've gone to a different planet. It's so different. How much of that is a result of generations of redlining and discriminatory lending practices that were in San Antonio for a long time? And it's all documented. I'm not having to make that up. It's all out there. But we knew that it was really hard for people, for builders and for individuals who wanted to live in certain parts of San Antonio. They were forced into certain parts of the city, low-income parts of the city, and they have not great schools, and it's a cycle, and it's hard to change.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, Dr. Drennan at Trinity University has done a lot of work on that, and many, due to redlining, many people have not been able to acquire that asset, pass that asset through generations to build that family wealth. So absolutely, it's
and it was because of that redlining that we ended up with the 1968 Fair Housing Act that was supposed to end it, but we know through data analysis, things like this still go on today. I mean, is that right, Sandra?
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, we all have this dream to one day own a home, and that's one of the ways to build wealth is through home ownership. And, you know, I think one of the things that this housing task force Policy Task Force is trying to do is make suggestions to our local government on ways to increase both affordable rental housing, but also affordable homes for purchase in areas of higher opportunity. And that caller is exactly right. That's the thing that we talk about over and over again is how our city is the most economically segregated in the country. And so there needs to be incentives that the government puts forward for developers. There needs to be changes to our zoning laws regarding what can be built where. There needs to
be. But the problems that were created over generations are not going to be solved overnight. But what's next for the mayor's housing policy task force? When were they going to make recommendations to city council?
A question for me. Each subcommittee is working through that process right now. I'd want to defer to the timeline of the mayor's office regarding final publication and when the recommendations are. It's going to be a fairly short process that crunches a lot of data in a very short time period. There's a lot of really good people on all the subcommittees, so I would anticipate something coming out within the next 3 to 6 months. Then we'll probably go through another round of evaluation.
And LeVar Martin?
Sure. So yeah, we've been engaged in that process, the task force process, and the recommendations from the working groups will go to the task force in around August.
So things are in progress right now. Right. Look for developments. I want to thank all of our guests as we wrap up the program. David Nesivacha, he is the president and CEO of the San Antonio Housing Authority. LeVar Martin is the director of programs for the National Association of Latino Community Asset Builder. Sandra Tamez is the executive director of the Fair Housing Council of Greater San Antonio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.